May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Daniel Hillis, and I represent Monterico, or defendant appellant Monterico Johnson. We've raised four issues on appeal. I'll begin with the Batson issue. Batson requires a three-part inquiry. First, the defendant must establish a prima facie case of improper exclusion. Second, the government must then offer a neutral explanation for the exclusion, justifying its reason. Third, the district court must make a determination about the explanation, engaging in credibility determinations.
And so what I'm trying to grapple with is what would be gained by remanding this back on a Batson challenge when the government used peremptories equally between men and women in the round that's at issue here, and it struck a male in its only other peremptory. So I'm having trouble understanding how you make a prima facie case of discrimination.
I think, Your Honor, under McMath, we have gone beyond the need to make the prima facie case. We hope that defense counsel's efforts were sufficient in the first instance in raising the challenge that did. I don't think that he really had a full opportunity to explain because the district court was pretty quick out of the gate saying, I don't see where the improper exclusion is. But if you look to the voir dire transcript on that in pages 63 and 64, it's pretty obvious that the district court's focus was on race discrimination. In fact, to quote from the transcript, they're all Caucasian. That doesn't get us to the racial, or excuse me, that gets to the racial discrimination. It does not address the gender discrimination. Insofar as what is to be gained, the difference of one juror is important. It could be the difference between a hung jury or perhaps in a literary refuge, 12 Angry Men, where you have one juror, given the evidence here is not of the Henry Fonda sort, but able to champion the cause, look at the evidence in a critical way, different from the remaining jurors. So I think the exclusion of one juror is an essential aspect of this case, and there is something to be gained in that regard, but also procedurally to have the opportunity to contest, and that wasn't allowed.
Are you saying that the defense lawyer was silenced?
If you look at the transcripts, the defense lawyer is trying to make his argument. The district court quickly said, I don't see where the improper exclusion is.
Right. But, I mean, defense lawyers are usually not noted for shyness and making a record. I don't see this at all. What am I missing?
Your Honor, the defense lawyer had made unsuccessful efforts in way of motion practice prior to this stage of the proceedings. I'm not certain why he didn't advance the issue further, but in any event, under McMath, we have a situation where the government then advances non-discriminatory reasons. And in doing so, the prima facie case it becomes moot. So procedurally, at that juncture,
this sounds like a way of taking an utterly baseless Batson challenge and turning it into a ground for reversal, simply because everybody realized it was so baseless and moved so quickly, and the defense counsel never made a record about it.
I see it differently, Your Honor. I see the defense trying to advance gender and race, the district court focusing exclusively on race, not on gender, and therefore the reasons weren't able to be fully explained or weren't fully explained. But in any event, when the prosecution advances its neutral, non-discriminatory reasons under McMath and by relation Hernandez, it then becomes incumbent on the district court to make a credibility determination of the third factor of the Batson test.
No, but then when the court said that and said, I don't think, you know, you have two of the male, two female, I don't think there's a basis for it. The AUSA has to make a record. The AUSA stated that one of the women testified that she actually was a witness in a criminal case for a defendant, and the other one works with troubled kids, including people who involve drugs. So, I mean, the defense could have then given some response. You're not saying the defense was shut down from doing that.
I'm saying at that point where the district court says, okay, all right, not enough happened. The district court needed to assess the explanations.
And that's why defense counsel should have said that.
If he said that's good enough, but that would have been enough, right?
I think that the lack of findings on the record would be troublesome on appeal. We don't know what the district court thought that was adequate. By way of the factual summary offered by the government, we know, for instance, that somebody testified for the defense. We don't know that it was criminal defense. If the district court were to assess the reasons given by the government and make, say, a record determination about the credibility assessment comparing the explanation to a jury questionnaire, things of that nature, we would have a better record. And we might also have an instance where it would be present based on the record that the explanation from the government was either plausible or implausible. But in any event, we have too little here. We have three words, okay, all right. The district court needed to say more to have an adequate record for us to know what the basis was and if the credibility determinations were sufficient. They were not made. I believe that's procedural error, and that, under McMath, requires a remand. Turn next to the career offender argument. The career offender argument is another instance where the district court said too little. Under United States versus Cunningham, it is error for a sentencing court to fail to mention a sentencing argument that has legal merit. The career offender provision was the subject of Mr. Johnson's criticism. He raised a valid sentencing argument when he criticized the severity of the career offender provision. He supported his argument by relying on the Sentencing Commission's 2004 15-year report. The district court never addressed that argument. It seems only to have considered a variance due to family situation, and I believe the government's view on that was the same, and I believe it's page 24 of the government's brief where it, further on than that, where the government says that the defense made a variance argument based on family history. It's on page 24 of the government's brief where it says the defendant's counsel asked for a downward variance based upon the defendant's family situation. What is clear enough from the transcript is that the district court at sentencing never addressed the career offender argument, and it was a valid argument. Sentencing Commission and numerous courts have criticized the guideline provision. The career offender provision should have been addressed. Mr. Johnson was barely a career offender. So his argument in relation to the various criticisms that have been levied against that provision especially had merit, where the district court's basis for imposing a 210-month sentence, which was the low end of the guideline, but a considerable range, 210 to 262 months. Absent one of the requisite convictions, the guideline range would have been 33 to 41 months. So we have an instance where, to rely on a well-worn phrase from the various criticisms, there are career offenders and there are career offenders. We have somebody here who was barely a career offender. If the district court were to have assessed the guidelines and recognized the criticisms, engaged in some statements about why it accepted the career offender provision, we might have a different case. But under United States versus Corner, the district court was able to vary from the guideline range, from the career offender range. It said nothing about that. I believe that is procedural error. It should have been addressed. It wasn't. Too little was said. And therefore, under Cunningham, we believe that a remand is appropriate.
Was Mr. Johnson subject to a statutory minimum?
Mr. Johnson's count of conviction, Your Honor, I don't believe that he was subject to a mandatory minimum.
That's my recollection. Not the 180 Armed Career Criminal Act?
No. He was not deemed to be armed career criminal. He was career offender.
Thank you.
Yes.
And then can you speak to this condition of supervised release, this sexual treatment?
Yes, Your Honor. The primary concern about that is that while the district court can impose conditions of supervised release, which would include a condition like this, it has to be in instances under 3583D where the condition is reasonably related to the 3553A factors. We have a very distant sex offense conviction. It is a 1997 offense. My client was 17 years old. He had sex with a girl who was over the age of 13, under the age of 17. He was convicted of a misdemeanor. He received a term of probation. There is nothing in regard to that conviction that should have subjected him to any sort of rehabilitative requirement this many years later, close to 20 years later, on an offense such as this that involved drugs and a gun. There's no relationship between the term of supervised release and sex offender treatment necessary for his rehabilitation in regard to the offense that he was committed of, or he was convicted of.
Do we know the facts of the aggravated battery home invasion?
Only in regard to the transcript, and that was not objected to, Your Honor. And so the statements that are contained in there I understand to be true. The circumstances of the conviction were admitted to. The charging document is what it is. The defense counsel in the prior proceedings objected to the home invasion and did not object to the aggravated battery conviction. The aggravated battery conviction, though, had some pretty unflattering facts that were alleged in the information, and as far as what the defendant admitted in the colloquy, I believe that that was also unflattering, although it was then later somewhat disputed in the PSR when there was a statement, and I believe it's that he denied striking the victim in that case, but that's as much as I know.
Was go ahead.
So with respect to the sex offender treatment.
Oh, I'm sorry. So the question came back to me, counsel. Was there any signal before the judge orally imposed the sexual treatment condition, any signal in the PSR or in the transcript that the judge was considering that?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the circumstances are similar in that regard to United States versus Goodwin, where it was not the prior practice of the probation office to include what the various terms of supervised release were. Therefore, defense counsel wasn't able to object and so on. Therefore, I think the circumstances are very similar procedurally as to this case in Goodwin, and therefore abuse of discretion, I believe, is an appropriate standard. But even if it were plain error, I come back to the necessity of the condition and its relationship to the count of conviction. And it's a 3-year term of supervised release. It will be burdensome and onerous on Mr. Johnson to comply with any condition. I assume that probation is going to ask that he participate in this. Otherwise, they wouldn't have interjected the condition in the first place. And insofar as the government might say the condition hasn't been imposed yet, well, I think that we should get away from the idea of including conditions of supervised release that we may not seek, and instead come back on the 3582 and modify a condition of supervised release to then add a condition when it's necessary based on the supervision history of the individual and not prospectively employ something that is onerous and burdensome. And, of course, he will not have defense counsel appointed to represent him at some point later. So to say that he should forestall his challenge and come back to it at some later date, challenge the condition, I think is incorrect. And insofar as the government relies on United States versus Ross, I hope that we've sufficiently distinguished that case from this to show why the reliance on Ross is misplaced. We have here a case where it's a sex offense unrelated to the offense of conviction. There's incredible distance in the temporal proximity between the offense of conviction, the misdemeanor offense, the sex offense, and the present count of conviction that led to the imposition of the term of supervised release.
I want to save the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Please, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hall. Phyllis. Mr. Norwood.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. With respect to the Batson issue, this is the first time we're making a record. It's caused more problems than not making a record for me. But it's clear from the transcript that Judge Gilbert did not find a prima facie case of any type of improper discrimination in the jury selection. And even when I asked Judge Gilbert if I could make a record, he said that's up to the government. So he wasn't asking for it. His decision had already been made. One thing I think is interesting is I've always tried to figure out, well, on appeal, how did appellate counsel know that the discrimination was based on female versus male, since it's not even mentioned at the trial below? I believe it was because defense counsel did not read the full transcript and thought some of the reasons I gave for the women were pretextual, and therefore that must be it must be based on the female gender as opposed to the male gender. But this case does not need to be remanded on the Batson issue because defense counsel conceded in his initial brief his justifications for the two ladies were non-discriminatory. The facts just weren't supported by the jury selection transcript, and they are supported by the jury selection transcript. But I don't even think you need to reach that. I think the very simple answer is there was no prima facie case. That's what Judge Gilbert found. That's the end of the issue. With respect to the career offender issue, I think it's important to note a couple things. One, with respect to the written objections to the pre-sentence report, the defense counsel raised a challenge to the career offender guidelines, but it was not the commission study. The objection was that one of the predicate convictions was not a crime of violence, that being the home invasion. It wasn't until sentencing, and he raised it orally about this 15-year commission study, it was raised orally in two sentences, I think a total of three sentences, two at one point and one at another, in this long sentencing hearing. Judge Gilbert clearly understood the defendant was asking for a variance and clearly rejected the defendant's request for a variance. Judge Gilbert explained the reasoning, based on the 3553A factors, why he was sentencing Mr. Johnson to where he was. With respect to the argument that absent the career offender guidelines, he would be looking at 33 to 41 months, that's not accurate either, because the defendant was initially charged with just being a felon in possession of a firearm. Those guidelines came to about 7 years. The defendant didn't want to do 7 years of time, so he wanted to go to trial. We then added the crack count, and I explained to his counsel this would up his sentence based on the career offender provisions, and that's what happened. He initially had a 10-year cap with just a felon in possession charge, and when he went to trial, we added the charge involving the crack cocaine. But his guideline range would have been higher than 33 to 41 months just on the gun charge alone.
He had 3 grams?
Yes, Your Honor. And it was all in one transaction. Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the condition of supervised release, the government submits the plain air standard applies in this case, and Your Honors look to see whether there has been a miscarriage of justice.
Was there any advance signal that this term was going to be imposed?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Okay. I'm trying to go back to the pre-sentence report and see if it was mentioned in that, but I just don't remember off the top of my head whether it was or not.
Apparently not, but that under Goodwin would seem to suggest that we just apply straight appellate review, abuse of discretion.
Your Honor, I must confess, I've read cases, and it seems like there are cases where the defense counsel do not object with respect to sentencing provisions, and it's always on a plain air standard of review. So
it depends upon, or at least we seem to be finding our way to a standard where it depends upon whether there was any advance notice. We say repeatedly that exceptions are not required. After the judge has ruled, that if the judge has given no advance indication of the ruling, has not heard arguments from either side about that particular issue, then the judge is sort of out on a limb, without the benefit of the potential waiver or forfeiture arguments. So.
I understand the court's position. I still think defense counsel can, if they want to, they can still raise an objection for the record.
They can, sure.
But
the rules say they don't have to.
Well, and even under the abuse of discretion standard, it becomes, I think, a closer question based on the case law. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that when Mr. Johnson gets out of prison, the probation office will do an evaluation, first of all, to see if this sex offender treatment is even necessary. And if it's not necessary, the government's not going to waste resources treating somebody for something that's not necessary.
Yeah, the point is, I mean, what is the connection between the 97 misdemeanor conviction and the current need for sex offender treatment? There was nothing in the PSR that suggested a need for it. It wasn't a condition recommended.
No, Your Honor, and like I said, I think, as Judge Hamilton said, the judge imposed the condition.
I was just asking you because clearly there's no record, and no. It's hard for me to see what the connection is.
No, Your Honor.
There's no comment made on it at all. And like your point is well taken, that even without this condition, once he's released, the probation officer can look at the circumstances and make a judgment as to what recommendations they might want to make.
Yeah, and they might say,
and could also do this if it was warranted.
Yes, Your Honor, and they could say that no sexual offender treatment is necessary. Also, the defendant has an opportunity to request that the court modify that condition. I just think
where the default position lies is an important question here, right?
Where the default position?
It matters who has responsibility for going forward when Mr. Johnson finishes his sentence.
Who has the responsibility for going forward, whether probation or he does?
Yes, exactly. You don't think that makes a difference?
No, Your Honor, in this respect, the defendant can ask the court to modify it on day one without doing anything. As soon as he gets released on supervised release, he can ask the court, this term needs to be modified.
Does he have counsel?
At that point, I am guessing not, Your Honor.
So am I.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the problem.
Well,
not represented then. So then, and you're certainly not going to go back all these years and try to find the original counsel.
I have found defendants to be pretty understanding of their rights, even non-supervised release. But, I mean, that's a decision. The record's before Your Honors. Your Honors can make the decision. I just, what you know about that condition being imposed is the same thing I know. So I have nothing really to add, Your Honors.
Fair
so
enough.
We all know nothing, right?
Well, we all know the reason why was based on
well,
the
know what the prior
the underlying
was.
Prior
that's
was.
It.
Yes,
but that's it.
Yes, Your Honors. Yeah. If there are no further questions,
thank you, Mr. Hillis. How much time?
Your Honor, under this court's jurisprudence under McMath, once the government offers an explanation, a neutral explanation, for its reasons to strike a juror, the district court has an obligation to make an assessment, and that was not done here. That requires remand under McMath on the Batson issue. With respect to the career offender, while counsel says that it is clear what the government's arguments were, but more importantly, what the judge's reasons were, it is not clear from the record because the judge does not address the argument made by defense counsel, and there are a few arguments made here. So I think that it's fair to say this was a principal argument, if not the
principal.
Well,
but it wasn't advanced apparently in the written sentencing memorandum. It was just raised orally at sentencing and in a very perfunctory fashion.
It was not addressed in as great a detail as we'd like, but it was raised nevertheless, and therefore.
Well, was it raised in terms of the career offender guideline sentence being excessive, based
yes.
on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission 15-year review? Was that in the written sentencing memorandum?
Yes, I believe that was specifically argued that the deterrent effect, and of course, in the statement of reasons, at the sentencing hearing. That was a primary basis for the sentence that was imposed. The 210 months was the need for deterrence. And in the limited regard that the career offender argument was made by defense counsel, it was to say that deterrence isn't achieved through the imposition of these types of severe sentences on minor cases. And here we have a 3-gram defendant who's now serving 210 months. Of course, there's a gun as well. As for...
So, refresh my recollection. So was the Sentencing Commission saying we should disregard their career offender guidelines in this report?
No, it was not. But it was saying that we should be mindful of the differences between the types of career offenders. And when we have minor street-level dealers, this is the type of sentence that may be inappropriate, and that's what we have here. If I may just briefly conclude, as to the third issue, it is the government's burden to persuade the necessity of the sex offender treatment condition. I don't believe that this court has specifically ruled on that, but the Ninth Circuit has, United States versus Rudd. And then finally, the government has confessed error on the fourth issue. To remand on all of the issues asked for by the defense would practically require very little, since the government has confessed error on the fourth issue in any event.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. And you were appointed, were you not?
I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office.
Federal Public Defender. Well, we thank you for your service. We have two government employees in.
We see both you and Mr. Norwood often.
Right. So we appreciate both of your efforts. We'll take the case under advisement.